amazed at what I am. I say what I think that the...
Hi, my name is Paul Smart. This is June Pledge Week on WGXC 90.7 FM. And this is a special edition of The Work Show, all about the new move to unionize adjunct professors and others in intellectual career paths, is playing out this week at Marist University. We recently spoke to philosophy professor Nico Varoli about union benefits, the changing nature of labor, and the new search for what leisure means to people and civilization. To donate, please call 518-697-7400 now or contribute online at wgxc.org/donate. If I strike for higher pay, when I show my card to the Scotland Yard, and this is what I say. Oh, you don't get me, I'm part of the union. You don't get me, I'm part of the union. You don't get me. We have been talking to, we meaning a group of Marist adjunct, and we're in touch with the SEIU, the Service Employees International Union, has a project called Adjunct Action, which has been organizing about 20,000 adjuncts nationwide over the last 2 to 5 years. I can't quite remember how long. And they got in touch with some of us in January, at the beginning of the semester. And so we started, you know, we were all interested in starting a union at Marist. For myself, I can say that I was particularly struck by the story that came out in the Chronicle of Higher Education and the New York Times, revealing that the president of Marist had made $2.3 million last year, and there was... at the end of the fall, this was revealed, and there was an interesting sort of exchange on the Marist faculty email server about the significance of this. One full-time, I think, retired faculty, pointed out that, it seemed rather amazing that the president of the university would be making something like 40 or 50 times more the average salary of a tenured faculty member. And he actually got, from some of the other faculty, got a lot of kickback for saying that. People were very upset that that anyone would suggest that there was anything, you know, worth criticizing there. And at the time, it had struck me that that was one thing for the tenured faculty, but how small a percentage of that money would he have had to forego in order to grant every adjunct at Marist College the possibility of getting health care, which of course none of us have. And so when we were approached by the organizers, or when I was approached by the organizers from Adjunct Action, I thought, well, that seems like a really worthwhile endeavor to try to organize an adjunct union at Marist. I've thought that unions for adjuncts would be a good idea for a very long time. But no unions have been interested in them. I've been an adjunct for 15 years, and no unions have been interested in them. I tried organizing a bargaining unit at one of my previous places of employment with some colleagues at Seattle University in 2004, 2005, and we contacted some organizers from the UAW, United Auto Workers, who apparently were the most involved at the time in helping academics and in particular graduate students organize unions.
And they had told us, Seattle U is a Jesuit university, and they had told us that there was a ruling by one of the federal circuit courts that made it extremely difficult for organizing unions at religious institutions, that had been ruled a violation of freedom of religion, and so we had given up. But there was, what they had failed to mention is that you can organize a union at a religious institution so long as the institution accepts. You can't force them to recognize you through the NLRB, but if they, you know, are willing to hold up to their, you know, ethical and moral mission, you can actually sort of morally compel them to do so. And that's precisely what's happened. Actually, at Seattle University, there is, I think, a vote scheduled for this summer. This is, has nothing to do with me, but Adjunct Action has been very aggressive nationwide in organizing adjuncts, including at CLU. So they had the backbone to do it, and I think I was very happy for that, and I sort of joined in the process. And so starting in late January, six or seven of us, along with a group of organizers, started talking with our colleagues at Marist and getting them to sign union authorization cards. We got a fairly large percentage of them to sign fairly easily before it came out that we were doing this. At which point things became a little bit more difficult. There was there's a small contingent of people who for whatever reason, I mean, for, you know, their own reasons, who are adjuncts themselves, who decided to speak up against the effort and publicly online and so on, and so people got scared. I think a lot of people got very scared. And the vice president, Marist vice president for academic affairs at that point, sort of came in and said, you know, we understand that there's a union drive, and we, you know, support everybody's right to unionize or to, you know, speak their mind. We support freedom of speech, but you know, we're against the organization of a union of adjuncts at Marist, or we don't think that it would be a good idea. And so, you know, that signified the administration's sort of perspective on organizing. Like, didn't interfere with it directly or anything like that. They're clearly against the possibility, at this point at least, seem to be against the organization of an union at Marist. And so, but we were able to get the, you know, there's a 30% threshold of the potential members of a bargaining unit that have to sign an adjunct authorization card in order for a vote to be triggered by the NLRB. And we reached and went some ways beyond that threshold and delivered our union authorization cards to the NLRB, I think, about a month ago. And last week had a meeting with the lawyers for the administration, who are themselves lawyers from KBS, which is one of the large just law firms specializing in how do they call it, union dissuasion tactics, I think. Uh-huh. Is the proper term for union busting nowadays. And they asked us to, you know, they basically tried to drown us and asked us to include as people that we hadn't had a chance to talk to into the bargaining unit to try to drown out the percentage of cards that we had. and make it go below the 30% threshold. But we had such broad support from adjuncts at Marist that did not succeed as a tactic, and so we are now scheduled to have a vote that will include online adjuncts, adjuncts at Marist's Albany campus, adjuncts at Marist's Fishkill campus, along with all adjuncts at Marist itself. And, you know, adjuncts at Marist account for 70% of the teaching load. There's 350 of us, you know, between 350 and 400 of us in any given year. That's about two or three times the number of full-time faculty.
But then what does the creation of the union involve? Why is it so frightening to them to have a union?
I can't pretend to speak for the administration or to understand its motivations. I think that from my perspective, if there is a union at Marist, it will be a great opportunity for an institutional renewal of Marist, and in general, it'll be a great opportunity for an institutional renewal of universities in the United States. This is the case at Marist. In the U.S. as a whole, adjuncts also account. I mean, Marist is very much in the trend. Adjuncts also account for about 70% of the teaching load of the faculty in the U.S., in all U.S. Institutions of higher education. So what that means is that decisions about the future of higher education are made without input from the overwhelming majority of the teachers in Americans and the U.S.'s institutions of higher education, and so as a result, the decisions are guided by concerns which do not exclusively have to do with the pursuit of knowledge and the education of America's young people, and I think as a result, the best decisions for those two purposes, which are the purposes of American universities, are not always, you know, at the forefront of the minds of the people who are making these decisions. Unionizing adjunct professors, which is to say the overwhelming majority of university faculty, will give us. A voice to change that the way in which those decisions are being made and take into account what we think are what are clearly the core missions of American universities.
Are there any places that have successfully unionized adjunct faculty?
Yeah, there's a bunch. Most recently, up in Boston, there were a couple of places. I think last week, was it? I would have to check on this, but I think Northeastern just unionized 2,000 adjuncts. George Washington University was the first one. A year ago, I believe, and they were just able to secure their first contract. Every couple of weeks, there are more universities and colleges whose adjuncts are able to have been able to get a bargaining.
Hi, this is The Work Show. My name is Paul Smart, and we are speaking today with Professor Nico Varoli about the unionization of adjunct professors at Marist University and other local colleges. To make a pledge to keep this and other shows on the air here at WGXC, please call 518-697-7400 now or contribute online at wgxc.org/donate. To continue.
Marist, I think the starting pay per course now is $2,700 per course. So it's very low. You, in addition, cannot teach more than five courses. They simply will not let you teach more than five courses a year, because that would mean that you would reach a part-time status, in which case you would be eligible for health insurance benefits paid for by the university. There's clearly a lack of will in that direction on the part of the administration. This is something I can speak to from personal experience, but in general, that's the case for all adjuncts. So five courses a year at $2,700 a course with no other benefits, you do the math, you see, for people who are relying, for their full income on teaching, it's simply an unsustainable situation. So it means that people are having to, find jobs at other institutions and have to run around on the expressway, are teaching, four, five, or six courses per semester in order to survive, which means, you count about between 25 and 30 students per course. If you're teaching five courses, you are 3 × 5 = 15, you have 150 students. If you're teaching in the humanities and social sciences, that means that your capacity of teaching your students to write, which is one of the, fundamental functions that a college education is fulfilling at this point, or is supposed to fulfill, is next to impossible. You can't grade 300 or 450 papers. It's impossible to do the best job that we can possibly can teaching. It's just, not physically possible to have the time to grade, to give that many people the individualized education that they need. That's, especially tragic in the current environment, where you have, a long-term decline in primary and secondary education, which means that students who are getting to college are getting there frequently less prepared than they used to be, in need of greater support, in need of more educational support in terms of writing, in terms of reading skills, in terms of critical thinking skills, and so on and so forth. Like, if you overtax the faculty who are teaching those students, and that's the same thing for the faculty in higher education as it is for the faculty in secondary education, if you overtax the teachers, if you give them too large a teaching load at once, there is no way that they'll psychologically, physically, intellectually be able to cope with it. The current system is unsustainable. We received a letter from the president of the university on the day that were able to establish a date for a vote on the adjunct faculty union, in which he talked about the recommendation of a joint faculty administration committee on the budget, in which he said, in which the president's, in this email, the president discussed the results of that committee's meetings, and suggested that the results were that Marist was going to have to undergo pretty significant transformations of its educational model to continue being viable, especially in the arts and sciences, and that this was the case for Marist and for higher education in the United States as a whole. I'm not surprised that the president of Marist would say that. I'm not surprised that you know, everywhere people are talking about how higher education has changed. Tuition is too high. Unemployment is also too high. People are not, you know, able to sustain the kind of debt load that they're acquiring by going to college in the current depressed job market. It's been depressed for 5 years. The forecast, the economic forecast, seems to suggest that there's no light at the end of the tunnel, that this is a long-term trend. So something is going to have to change, right? Studies are starting to come out suggesting that going to college is not as great a deal as it used to be, and so on and so forth, right? People are you know, the change is in the air, right? And so the question is, what kind of change, right? And for me, as a faculty, the question I have for myself, for my colleagues, for the administration, the administrators at the institutions where I'm teaching, is how is this change going to be decided? Will we faculty have a say in what those changes are going to look like, and in whether they're going to result in a better education for our students, or if they're simply going to result in cost-cutting measures like putting all courses online and increasing the size of classes exponentially, because once your courses are online, whether you have 25 or 150 students in them, nobody can tell. It doesn't matter anymore. And it is, you know, from a strictly managerial standpoint, a very short-sighted managerial standpoint, it is a great cost-cutting tactic. From the standpoint of an actual education, from the standpoint of an actual college education, where students have the opportunity to have one-on-one conversations with their faculty, have interactions with each other, right, which is where a great deal of the learning happened, is peer-to-peer, that solution would be disastrous. And yet it is the one that is being proposed by some in higher education, right? I think we can do better than that, and I think that the existence of adjunct unions can only, you know, improve the level of the conversation and the put more options on the table for all of us to consider about how exactly higher education is going to change in the United States in the 21st century. The tenure process started in the 1950s as a result of the McCarthyite purges of universities. It was a way of ensuring freedom of speech for faculty, and the security of knowing that no matter what your, you know, political opinions were, you weren't going to be fired from the university where you taught at. What's happened over the years, though, is that being tenured and speaking your mind politically have become more and more antithetical to each other, so far as I can tell, right? Because if you're tenured and you say something that the administration doesn't like, and you will, you know, if you're an associate professor, you will not become an assistant professor. You will not be promoted to the level of assistant professor. If you're an assistant professor, you will not be promoted to the level of full professor. If you're asking for a sabbatical, if you're asking for grant money to do your research, your chances of, you know, if you're active and voluble and so on in your opinions, and they run against the opinions of the administration, you're just going to get passed on all of these promotions, research funds, and so on and so forth, and you will have no, you may not get fired, in other words, but you will get no promotion, and you will have no way of appealing any of these decisions, because the university, basically, even though it's very difficult for it to fire you because you're tenured, there is no independent arbitrator to adjudicate between your claims and those of the
university. Remember, he's coming up with
that. It is true that universities do have been supposed to at least bring a moderate amount of protection to freedom of thought, to freedom of inquiry, from the forces of the market, from the pressures of profit, and so on and so forth, right? And less over the last 20 years, right? Over the last 20 years, since basically I started graduate school, the model of the university that has been put forward by managers overwhelmingly and expected by politicians in public universities, put forward by administrators in private universities, has been the corporate model of education, right? Where universities are supposed to be able to sustain themselves economically and possibly produce surpluses.
Mm-hmm.
And so of course that directly undermines the possibility of universities as being the kinds of places where people are protected from the force of the market in order to think creatively about their society, about their discipline, you know, and so on and so forth in fundamental ways, right? So universities have become more and more dependent as public funds for university education has decreased over the last 20 or 30 years. More and more universities have become dependent on private foundation and corporate funds for research, and that has affected every sector of the university, and in particular, it has affected the natural sciences, right? Where people now have to basically raise the funds for their own salaries in order to to remain employed by the university from private and public sources. Though since public funds have shrunk tremendously, it's largely from private sources, which means that they have to come up with projects that are, that can conceivably create a turnover and a profit in the relatively short term, which means that fundamental research is affected, you know, pretty tremendously.
Is this cutting our intellectual stamina, our intellectual abilities?
I think so. I mean, my sense is I don't know if it's happening on a global scale. I do know that similar trends are affecting European institutions of higher education in very different contexts. France, which is the other country that I'm most familiar with outside the United States, is different from the U.S. because most of its universities are fully funded and free of access to students. But even there, from what I understand, adjunct labor is more frequent than it used to be. With the results of the crisis of 2008, there's less state funds for fundamental research and so on and so forth. So I assume some similar processes are taking place there and in other European countries as well. I don't know what the situation is in Latin America, for instance, which has a very different sort of political mm-hmm. trajectory than Europe and the United States, especially over the last 10 years.
Is there an underlying politics to this? I mean, sometimes you can look at it in certain ways and see certain political forces really kind of having spent a long time pushing against the influence of intellectual thought in universities, or is it pure just the political force that is the free market system?
Well, I mean, you know, the free market is a decision that people make, right?
Yeah.
It is a decision about how to organize a society's priorities. Whether you organize them for the pursuit of private profit, in the hopes that pursuit will inevitably trickle down to the public good, or you organize your society directly for the common good using the institutions that are available, namely the state, nonprofit institutions, cooperatives, and so on and so forth, right? Those are, at this point, two relatively different models. The former is the one that is being explored in the United States and Europe and Russia. The latter is the one that is being explored in Latin America, for the most part. I'm talking simply over the last decade.
And I always get my way if I strike for higher pay. When I show my card to the Scotland Yard, and this is what I say.
We are speaking with Nico Veroli, an adjunct professor of philosophy at Marist University, about unionization in academic circles as part of the June edition of the Work Show. It's also Pledge Week here at WGXC, and we ask you to please give a little by calling 518-697-7400 now, or contributing online at wgxc.org/donate. Back to Nico.
Well, science, technology, engineering, and math are sort of related in this way, that from all of them you can, you know, create more technological innovations, right, on the basis of all of these, you know, understood in a certain way on the basis of all these disciplines, you can create more technological innovations. Technological innovations give individual entrepreneurs the opportunity, or corporate entrepreneurs the opportunity to create ventures that are profitable, to create commodities that they can then sell on the market, and so on and so forth, thereby creating profit, thereby creating wealth, and the idea being that, you know, ultimately that wealth, those profits, that technological progress has positive repercussions on the rest of society. My sense is that to a certain extent that has been true. It is a proposition of diminishing returns, right? That, in other words, it was true for 20 years. But throughout those 20 years, wages have been going down as a result, right? Stagnating, but over the last actually 40 years, wages have been stagnating since 1973 in the United States, or going slightly down. Cost of living has been increasing. The commodities available have been, you know, plentiful. And so the way that people have been able to afford those increases in the cost of living, those sort of, you know, extra necessary commodities like cell phones, PlayStations, you know, DVD players, Blu-ray players, you know, satellite, blah, 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 TV, and so on, has been on credit. And, you know, the era of credit is now over, right? So people are finding themselves with, you know, the middle class is finding itself with a decreasing net wealth, right? Decreasing incomes, there is increasing inequality at the national and at the global level, right? Some very few people at the very top are making most of the income, are accumulating most of the wealth, while the middle class is sinking in the United States, in Europe, you know, Greece being a great example of that. The middle class is sinking deeper and deeper into debt, is having less and less disposable income, is therefore able to spend less and less on the commodities that are being produced by the, you know, STEM paradigm. Ultimately that model is grinding very slowly, but it's grinding its way to a halt. There's a need for new perspectives on, you know, what we're going to do together as a country, and certainly as a planet, because global warming is not stopping, it's not cooling down. You know, sea levels are rising, parts of Antarctica are, you know, sinking, and so on and so forth. Like, what are we all going to do together? How are we going to conceive of our lives together? How are we going to organize ourselves? Who's going to make all of these decisions? I think those are, you know, the really crucial questions of the next 20 years.
Is a teaching profession, you know, or just an intellectual profession, how is it possible these days? How does one do it?
Well, I think, I mean, you know, in a lot of ways, I think this is why adjunct unions are so rapidly sort of mushrooming up everywhere around the country. It is because it's less and less obvious how it's possible to be an intellectual or how it's possible to be an academic to more and more people. I mean, it used to be that academics didn't want to join union because they perceived them as being, a status, a step down on the, yeah, on the status ladder, and so people were sort of like, well, I'm not a worker, I'm an intellectual, which, you know, supposed to be opposite things, at least in a lot of people's mind. In Marx's mind, they were certainly supposed to be opposites, right? That was the basis of the division of labor, according to Marx, is the division between manual and mental labor. And I think that was, that conception of division of labor was undoubtedly as much a product of the 19th century elitist paradigm to which Marx, along with many other intellectuals of his generation, subscribed, but it's certainly one that until recently a lot of academics sort of latched onto. I think that's changing, and I think it's changing for reasons of economic necessity. It's not possible to be an adjunct. Mm-hmm. That's the reality, right? And that's the reason why more and more adjuncts are, trying to join unions in order to better their lot. Look, when adjuncting was young, 20 or 30 years ago, people thought of it as something that they did in graduate school. People cannot get tenure track jobs. They're simply not available. Like, administrations have decided overwhelmingly to shift the burden of responsibility for teaching from tenured and tenure track professors to adjunct professors. So if you're an adjunct nowadays and you apply for a tenure track job, or you apply for even a full-time lecturer position, you're competing with between 1 and 300 other people for the same position. Like, there's just not enough jobs to go around, right? So something that used to be, something that you did for a short period of time, either right out of graduate school or while you were a graduate student, has now become, for most of the people who are practicing it, a condition. This is what you do. You're an adjunct. You know, I'm an adjunct. I'm most likely, so long as I remain an academic, I'm not going to be anything else but an adjunct. So there's no more West, is one way to put it. There's nowhere left to run. And so we are here now, and we have to make the best of our situation. And the only way to do so is for us to turn towards each other and talk to each other about what's wrong and what we want to see improved, and work towards improving that by collectively discussing those issues with our respective administrations. And because adjuncts teach at a number of different colleges at the same time, we're going to be having those conversations undoubtedly with multiple administrations at the same time. We are really the elephant in the room.
So will you be, at Marist, or just be a Marist union, or will it be part of a larger entity? Part of the SEIU or
SEI, the adjunct action has what they're calling a metro strategy, where they're trying to organize in specific geographical areas in order to get a certain amount of density, so that adjuncts who work in one geographical area will be there will be enough unions in that bargaining units in that geographical area to push the conditions up for all adjuncts in that area, right? So adjunct action is organizing at Marist. It's also organizing at other places in the Poughkeepsie, Kingston, Hudson Valley area, so as to get the kind of density that will make improvement of work conditions for all adjuncts in that area.
Do you see this happening in other, I mean, in other areas of work or areas of labor? I mean,
it appeared my life was as clear. Now I've got the power to the working hour and every other day of the year. So though I'm a working man.
Heavy Stuff is pushed to shift big economic trends as a means of saving the best of our civilization. And you heard it here on The Work Show on WGXC-FM, which is currently seeking your donations to stay on the air. Please call 518-697-7400 now or contribute online at wgxc.org/donate. Getting back to Nico Veroli, the idea of unionization. Are we going to see a revival of unions as a useful part, or the whole idea of organizing as a central part of our culture?
It's the question right now. I think for U.S. unions, the choice is fairly straightforward between changing and dying. Mm-hmm. And some of them are clearly trying to experiment with changing. So what's happened, again, over the last 40 years, I mean, that's really the time period that we're talking here, is at the same time that, you know, universities have become more and more staffed by precarious workers like adjuncts, the same thing has happened across the U.S. economy. That has been driven by a restructuring of the U.S. economy, at least according to economists and political scientists, around service labor. Right? That, in other words, more and more people are employed in the healthcare industry, in the food industry, in the software industry, teaching, and so on and so forth, right? Rather than producing widgets in a factory, which was the sort of industrial model of labor that kind of really took off after World War II and dominated the American economy in the 50s and 60s. Since 1970, there has been a shifting of the labor force more and more from industrial to service sectors of the economy. And as a result, those sectors which were part of the services industry before that were completely, like education, were completely transformed by that shift, right? Because the shift to service labor has meant a shift to more precarious labor, less unionized, right, part-time work, and so on and so forth, right? All these jobs that have been very difficult to unionize, and which have meant that the overall share of the labor force that was unionized fell, I think, from 20 or 25% in 1970 to about 9% now, or 8%. We're human beings, and we'll either, you know, create something new or die. That's really the choice. Like, I really think that, our time is fairly limited in which to do that. I think more and more people are sort of coming to the recognition that some fairly fundamental aspects of our societies, of our way of organizing ourselves, are going to have to change. Whether that's going to be reached by a balance of different traditional forces or by a structural shift entirely. My sense is, you know, that rebalancing is certainly part of what's going to happen, but the rebalancing is going to lead to things that are going to be very different than say, you know, the way U.S. society was structured in the 1950s and 1960s, for instance, when there was a sort of union, not a union, but an alliance between large unions and large corporations, mm-hmm. which enabled a kind of, you know, how would you call it, business-labor sort of understanding, right, where workers got more money and more benefits in exchange for allowing businesses to increase productivity and the intensification of the labor process itself, right? That was the strategy of the 1950s and 1960s. Again, we're at a point where labor productivity has been so radically intensified that that the results are, instead of being positive, creating greater profits and so on and so forth, there's a cycle of diminishing return, I think, that has been started. In other words, people are working, you know, 2, 3, 4 jobs, are pretty radically overworked. There's the result is illness, both of the physical and the mental kind, that is emerging, as a direct result of overwork, overstress, you know, etc., etc. So there needs to be, you know, a transformation, and you know, I think more and more people are sort of coming to the conclusion that there has to be some other meaning to their lives. Mm-hmm. Than simply working themselves to death, right? Which is, you know, really what's happening now. The question is, what is it? We live very much in a society that is where our identities are structured by what we do, by where we work, and so on and so forth. So, how do we build identities that are not entirely sort of swallowed up by our professional ambitions, right? Or sort of narrowed to our simple, you know, family desires, right? Family is a great thing so long as you can get away from it 8 hours a day when you have a job. What else are we going to do? And I think, you know, that's one of the great sort of potential functions of universities in the near future will be for students to start exploring and for all of us as a collectivity, as a society, to start exploring what else we can do aside from overworking ourselves to death. What other aspirations we can have as a society, as human beings, aside from working 2 or 3 or 4 jobs, or working an 80-hour week at our corporate job, you know, and so on and so forth. I think those questions are really worth asking, and they're worth asking because ultimately, work in and of itself cannot be meaningful. Work is simply the reproduction of life as it currently exists. It doesn't mm-hmm. involve, progress of the moral and spiritual kind that we need in order to figure out what to do with all those technological gizmos that we've been creating over the last 40 years of overworking ourselves so much, right? So what is it that we're going to do with Facebook? What is it that we're going to do with cell phones? Aside from, you know, text each other about, you know, where we are in the subway and what our next appointment is going to be. One of the courses I've taught in the past, which I would like the opportunity to do again, is a course on leisure and labor, mm-hmm. and on the relationship between the two. And, you know, there's a lot that's been written out there. Surprisingly, a great deal of it on this topic, surprisingly a great deal of it in the 1940s and 1950s, just mm-hmm. at the beginning of the sort of industrial phase of the expansion, you know, most recent industrial phase of the expansion of capitalism after World War II, a lot of people started asking themselves, well, is it really worth it to work so much, to produce so much, when we don't know, you know, what else we could do, what other potential.
Then everybody just started working so hard they couldn't ask themselves.
That's right. That might be.
I think those
questions were generally being asked, especially in the 1960s and the early 1970s. One of the things that you need to do in order to reflect on, you know, the nature of labor is to not work so much.
Yeah.
Right. And so, like, the only way for us to be having these conversations ultimately with our students in a way that's meaningful, because, I mean, that's really one of the problems that I think all academics encounter in their interactions with their students, right? The students come in, and they are completely freaked out about the debt load that they're about to start, that they are accumulating in college. They are accumulating upwards of $100,000 to $150,000 in student loans in college alone, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they know that they're going to have to come out, and more they're going to have to start making money right away in order to just be able to forestall the enormity of the interests that they're having to that they're accumulating on these loans, right, on top of the capital of these loans, and so that means that the students come in sort of really being really gung ho about their professional aspirations, without thinking about and sort of not very interested in anything that cannot, you know,
focus them and
give them an edge in terms of those ambitions and skills, gaining the skills to fulfill those professional ambitions. And so the result is that it is very, very difficult to make the case to them that they need to be thinking about something else. The way that I do it with my students is I tell them, if when they, you know, when they bring up those kinds of concerns, is I tell them, okay, so you're now, you know, really gung-ho about becoming a nurse or, you know, a geneticist, I mean, you know, whatever it is that they want to do. Think about, you know, 15 years down the road when you've worked at that job for 10 years and you know it really well. You've been at it 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 hours a day doing this job. What else is going to be in your life then? You'll probably want to start thinking about other things. What will you be able to fall back on in terms of skills that have not been entirely focused on this one endeavor that will enable you to sort of begin the process of broadening your mind? I realize that, you know, you have huge loans that are making it very difficult to focus on anything else but making money. But trust me, you know, as someone who's been through this process, their life, with a little luck, your life will be long enough for you to start getting bored of your job and to start asking questions about other things. That's what college is for, right? A college education enables you to learn on your own, ideally, right? Mm-hmm. People are coming out of college more and more prepared for very specific tasks in a labor market that is, you know, changing from minute to minute, where skills are constantly becoming obsolete, mm-hmm. right? And minute by minute, right? So a liberal arts education is all the more important, and yet all the more undermined at the very same time.
Yeah.
Right. So it's a vicious circle, and which is, you know, another reason why I think, you know, higher education is going to have to change. It's not the only thing that has to change, but the change has to start somewhere.
Yeah, yeah,
and you were asking me, you know, are there, you know, where are unions going today? I think unions are more and more successfully unionizing. Appealing to service sector workers, people mm-hmm. like, you know, adjunct professors, but also people like fast food restaurant workers, mm-hmm. right? People in sales, like the Walmart employees, right, have been trying now, and McDonald's employees have been trying to unionize for several years and have had very strong campaigns. Adjuncts are very much a part of that process, and that is, since the service sector is the, you know, growth sector of the U.S. economy, it does mean, if these efforts are successful, and all indicators tend to suggest that they are being successful, simply because there is no other option but to unionize for so many of us. Unions are going to regain a significant importance in the public debate in the United States.
We must fight for, from the cities and the farmlands to trenches full of mud. War has always been the boss's wiser. The Union forever defending our rights. Down with the black leg, the workers unite with our brothers and our sisters.
This has been the June Pledge Drive edition of The Work Show with Professor Nico Varoli, discussing major shifts in the way labor looks at unions and intellectual survival. Music was by The Straubs and Billy Brash. We hope you've been able to help us reach our Pledge Drive goal of $10,000 this hour. To give, please call 518-697-7400. Or contribute online at wgxc.org/donate. And remember, you can give again. I am your producer and host, Paul Smart. Keep us all working now. Until next month. Together.